Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today we're going to talk about the arts in the 18th century and more broadly the question of culture. And that, of course, is not an easy topic to approach. It might seem superficially so that one moves in assured ease and elegance from, for example, Vanbrugh to eventually Sheridan, or from Gainsborough to Reynolds, or the, you know, so on. It might seem that one just needs to pick the leading lights and produce a few pleasant comments about them, or some kind of Sharmaresque superficiality, and then we've sort of addressed it. But of course, if you're looking at culture, and the 18th century here is no different to any other period, there are the questions of how best to conceptualize it, there are the questions of what one should be talking about, and there is the questions of the significance of those matters. And it's helped if one, in offering those reflections, are aware about the extent to which there is no rigid, clear, or agreed account of the arts in that period, or indeed in any other period. And whoever claims authoritative status or definitive works is by their nature suspect. So what I'm going to offer is some suggestions, and I hope these suggestions are of interest, but these suggestions in no way exhaust the subject, nor do they define how it should be looked at. Those who want to take my views further can, of course, look at my book, A Subject for Taste, Culture in 18th Century England. But that, I'd like to think it's a good book, but it was written some years ago, and I've had opportunities since to reflect further upon the subject. So what sort of issues should one think about when one's considering the matrix of the subject, the parameters within which it ought to be discussed? First, there is, as in any period of history, the chronological one. In what way is the culture of the 1700s different to the culture of the 1790s in content, in context, in cause, or in consequence? And one could probe that further. One could look within any period of 100 years for continuity within that century, or divisions within that century, and continuities prior and subsequent. And in approaching that, one also has the question of how far one wants to shape it in terms of supposed styles and their supposed chronological sequencing and interrelationship. Are we talking about the English Baroque, British Baroque, or the Rococo, or the Neoclassical, or Romanticism, and so on or so forth? So that is one dimension to consider. Then there's the dimension to consider in terms of spheres of patronage and activity. Here we're moving from the producers of art to the consumers of the arts. Indeed, in a way, although one wishes to push the comparison cautiously, one is moving in a sort of analogous terms to different ways of looking at the Industrial Revolution. Do we focus on the producers, or do we focus on the consumers? And if one is focusing on the consumers, should one be looking at the crown, the aristocracy, the church, the middling orders, and the bulk of the population? Or should each of those be broken up further for classification and maybe overlapping? Then one is looking at geographical milieus. How much weight does one place on a British dimension? How much on different constituent parts between England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales? How much within each of those does one look at regionalism? Because clearly the cultural effort of Edinburgh or Glasgow is very different to the cultural effort that one might see in the Scottish Highlands. How far does one look at particular, as it were, media or mediums of artistic activity, whether one's thinking of books or newspapers, whether one's thinking of theatres or concert halls or assembly rooms, and so on and so forth. What basis does one look at the question of the relationship between domestic movements, however constituted, and international ones, however constituted, and what is the nature of the relationship one sees between them? And in that also, what place does one put for the British colonies? So there are a whole host of possible approaches that we can take, and all of those are, as it were, in terms of the 18th century, but there is also the question of the modern reading of the 18th century and how much attention we should place on the extent to which the 18th century culturally is created or was created by later sort of commentators, later emulators, later continuity, and how far was there an independent activity in which we should move away from that analysis. And I think one can see that very clearly at the end of the century with the coverage of Jane Austen, who, as I've indicated earlier, one of the programs in this on the Critic podcast, but also in my book on Jane Austen. Jane Austen is very different in contemporary terms to the way that she's been realized for modern audiences. And I think the same point could be made about other 18th century writers and painters and so on. So there are all of these critical, contextual points to consider. And I think it's fair to say that once one asks the questions, which is what we should do, we move away from the easy answers. And, you know, in a sense, focusing at that last point on Jane Austen exemplifies this, because Jane Austen today is treated with great attention, but in her lifetime, she didn't sell particularly well. And if you're looking at a great female writer of the 1790s who sold extremely well, you'd be looking at Mrs. Radcliffe. And Mrs. Radcliffe, novels such as The Italian or The Mysteries of Udolpho, which of course is satirized in Northanger Abbey. Well, Mrs. Radcliffe had the last laugh because her novels sold much better, and she was able to retire at 32 with a fortune under her belt. So I think, again, we have this problem of what is significance. I mean, one can read that through into the 19th century with novels such as Bulwer Lytton's Last Days of Pompeii, or the novels of Cain Hall, easily outselling many that today would be regarded as of greater interest and significance. So in part, it is a question of prizing the period, as any period, away from the dead hand of the theorist. And then, of course, one risks the danger that one turns out oneself as a commentator into a theorist. But the same point could be made in the 20th century. I mean, if you are looking at novels of the interwar period and readership of the interwar period, you would not necessarily be looking at Bloomsbury works. If you are looking at novels of the century as a whole, you should be probably looking at Agatha Christie, or a more mediocre writer, Frederick Forsyth, than many of the mediocre writers that attract critical acclaim. So that point made of the present day can then be read back into the past. And I want to pause at that point, having, as it were, established my questions, so that Graham can take part.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I want to start with asking how parochial we should see the artistic and cultural scene in Britain at the time. You, in your introduction remarks, you referred to, you know, the nature of English, Welsh, Irish, and Scottish. It's also obviously the period of the Grand Tour and so on, and considerable influences, considerable European influences, and indeed beyond. But how would you categorize the areas where the European influence was greatest in British cultural life in the 18th century?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I would say that it does have an influence across the range, but possibly in a different fashion to what we think about. So we would tend to think of Henry Fielding as a sort of vernacular roast beef of old England kind of writer, with Tom Jones or Joseph Andrews. But of course, Henry Fielding was interested in Don Quixote. He writes Don Quixote in England, etc., etc. You know, he'd been abroad. He has, as indeed most of the writers and painters of that period, including those who might present themselves in one or other guise as a xenophobe, Tobias Smollett, for an instance. But of course, Tobias Smollett had been abroad, wrote about abroad, and went abroad in his last years. So I think that through personal experience, many of them were cosmopolitan, but of course you can, as a cosmopolitan, be a well-informed xenophobe. In other words, there is a canard that if you are a xenophobe, you are inherently not anti-cosmopolitan. I think that's ridiculous. You may know a lot about the continent and come back convinced in the 18th century that Catholicism, say, is a terrible system, that the nature of autocratic government as you perceive it in France or Spain is appalling, etc., etc. So on the one hand, there is your cosmopolitan awareness of bigger questions about liberty placed in a broader non-British context, and on the other hand, that might cause you to feel praise. So, you know, I just simply mentioned those points.
Obviously, figures like Jane Austen didn't go to university, or universities weren't open to women, but more generally, looking at the novelists of the period, are most of them university men from Oxford and Cambridge, or are they more like, am I right in saying Defoe wasn't, he was a jobbing journalist rather than a man down from the schools? What was the sort of balance in terms of the successful writers of the era?
Well, the majority of people that went to university and then pursued most people didn't go to university. The majority of people that went to university and then pursued a career who were English, I mean, obviously there was a separate university system outside England, went into the church. And of course, it is worth bearing in mind that many of the intellectuals and cultural figures of the period were clerics. And that what to us might seem, a clerical branch of learning would not be incompatible with cultural norms and cultural interests. So I think we've got to be very careful. If you're looking at people from the universities, as you put it, who are culturally active, many of them will be clergy, many of them taking part in the kind of activities in which clerics chose to be or were particularly prominent: antiquarianism, philological work, and indeed writing on religious topics, which we would tend to see that as it were, separate to culture. That reflects more on us than it does reflect on the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. So that division between writing tracts and religious meditations would be seen within a broader literary and cultural sphere in the 18th century in a way in which we would divide it now.
Yes, I think I would say that. There's all sorts of writers writing all sorts of for all sorts of forms, from jobbing writers who may themselves be of great talent. I think most people would argue that Defoe or Goldsmith or Johnson was a jobbing writer after all, were, you know, very talented individuals. So I'm not sure that the kind of pejorative view towards ordinary writers is necessarily appropriate.
I mean, Austen is obviously not a London writer, but is there a, given, you know, the dominance of London as the great city, is there a large preponderance of a London view in the literature of the period, or actually it's much more regional than one might imagine?
I think, well, London is very important because London is the major centre of publication. It's the major centre of publication for all forms of printed media. It is the largest individual cultural market in the country. And indeed, by the end of the century, it's very, very clearly the largest city in Europe. Also, it's an important market, which, of course, is one of the things that attracts foreign producers of cultural matters, people, performers, people like Mozart or Haydn to come to, or Handel earlier, to come to London. And it also is a phenomenon that people are interested in looking at, so, you know, Voltaire or Montesquieu, for example. So London is very, very important, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an active cultural life and indeed intellectual life. Again, the two aren't in some way necessarily separate. In major provincial cities, places like Newcastle or Bristol, or indeed in some smaller places where there are clubs of people who meet and discuss books and intellectual matters. And some of these have attracted scholarly attention, the one in Spalding, the one in Northampton, and so on and so forth. And then on top of that, as we know, there's a vibrant cultural scene, to use a modern word, in Edinburgh, in Glasgow, and in Dublin, less so in Wales. I think Wales is a bit of an apology in cultural terms in the 18th century. But, you know, there are many important centres outside London in that period.
And would these literary clubs, these book clubs, would they be open to both sexes at the same time, or was that, you know, was that not considered the way to go?
On the whole, sociability was gender specific, shall we just say. There were indeed some, and I think this is very interesting, some ladies' publications, milieus, clubs, etc. And all of that is very interesting. But I think what one has got is a pattern of sociability that tends to be gender specific. So, I mean, a classic example in the 18th century is the development of Freemasonry, which is an 18th century development, London-based, and which is, you know, there are male lodges. It doesn't mean that there can't be female lodges, as indeed there are today, but it is very much male sociability that is the key element there. And of course, I've already referred to religion. Our religion, again, is significant in those terms.
We've talked in the past, quite distant past actually, on a podcast about the growth of newspapers in the 18th century. I wonder how what the relationship was between that growth of people reading newspapers and the ability of the press to promote artistic ideas. In the 19th century, you know, journals are serialising novels, Dickens, Scott, and so on. Did any of that happen in the 18th century? Did the newspapers advertise the, you know, the latest work by Henry Fielding? What was the relationship between these two different arms of publishing?
A lot of newspapers were owned by consortia of booksellers. You get regular excerpting of works, particularly in what we might call essay newspapers, like The Craftsman in the 1720s and 30s, which excerpted large chunks of Lord Bolingbroke's history. History was of great interest in that period as a form of culture. And yes, book advertisements are one of the principal forms of advertisements in newspapers in that period. And many printers are people who have a broad range. And remember, since novels like magazines often appear across a period of time, there isn't necessarily there's more of a continuum between forms of publishing than necessarily an abrupt break.
Mm-hmm. Censorship, it seems to me, dies almost by accident in the sense that the licensing acts which permit pre-publication censorship, they lapse and aren't renewed. Nevertheless, were other measures used? I mean, were there kind of cause célèbre of books that were subjected to censorship for their scandalous nature? Obviously, in theatre, we've got the Lord Chamberlain's Office, which is censoring plays before they're put on. What were the limitations on what you could publish as an author in the 18th century?
Well, as John Wilkes discovered, blasphemy was something you have to be cautious about. And he wasn't the only one by any means of that. Of course, Fanny Hill got it, the author got himself into trouble. But on the whole, I think it's fair to say that, as you correctly argue, the lapse of pre-publication censorship was followed by a less regulated, freer environment in which the major thing, this is for publications, the major thing was profitability and competition. Now, it's very different in drama, of course. The Licensing Act is passed for the theatre under the Walpole government. And that means that, in theory, there is quite a rigid and rigorous process of the evaluation of plays, which only ends in the 20th century, and also in terms of the theatres in which people can perform. But having said that, it needs to be noted that restrictions in practice often are different. So, as you know, I've written on the press in the 18th century, there are unlicensed newspapers. Now, these are newspapers that are, illegal, and yet you could buy them on the streets of London. And, the government launches periodic sort of attempts to close them down. And sometimes they're successful and sometimes they're not. But one would be naive if one reads from the law to practice. But on the other hand, I know you live in a part of the country where nobody breaks the speed limit and everybody pays their taxes fully. So, my remarks are probably extraordinary to you.
Well, I never cease to be amazed by the failings of other people. But I wonder whether there were kind of moral panics amongst church and state over what was being read, particularly the idea that, salacious or even seditious content was getting in the hands of people who were deemed not suitable to have their heads filled with such ideas.
Well, there are a number of very significant Tory clerics who produce alarms about the state of the playhouse in particular, as it were, the plays, the theatre, in the 1690s and 1700s. I think it's fair to say that then becomes less significant. There are, as you put it, moral panics, but possibly less commonly than is the case today. I mean, one of the charming idiocies of modern commentary is the assumption that things were worse in the past, and we have the monopoly of virtue. Those who, you know, take the view of virtue sticking to themselves the fur on a bee's legs. It's rubbish, of course, that, you know, we have a lot of moral panics, and in some respects, moral panics today are spread much more rapidly by the world of gossip, which is really what social media is about, but also by, in a sense, television and radio and the instant news aspects. There are moral panics in the 18th century. Some of them are aimed at what subsequently becomes respectable, Methodism, for example. Others we would regard as highly undesirable, the agitation against the Jewish Naturalization Act of 1753. But given the range of what was appearing culturally in a world that to somebody of the 1680s would have seemed singularly unregulated, what I think is remarkable is how few moral panics there were.
One of the developments of the era is obviously the development of the novel, but also the development of the Gothic novel, something you've written about in the print edition of The Critic. For those who missed the article, can you just rehearse really the origins of Gothic literature, where they came about, and you know how shocking, excitingly shocking they were perceived to be at the time.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, the Gothic novel is not the only form of interest in Gothic. There's an interest in Gothic in terms of architecture. There is a form of medievalism, the sort of soliloquies in a country churchyard, etc., etc. But the Gothic novel as a troubling adventure story in which hero or heroine are put in a world in which they do not know what is going on and whether evil is afoot, that is something that develops in the late 18th century, particularly prominent in Britain. There's also Gothic novels in Germany, incidentally, but it's particularly prominent in Britain, and it enjoys a particular vogue in the 1790s and 1800s, though there are later iterations. I mean, I would argue that Frankenstein is a Gothic novel, and I would argue that Dracula is a Gothic novel. Now, the Gothic novel itself, like any form of art, is not written to a template. Essentially, there is a major rift between those in which there is the real presence of real evil and those in which there is mystery, but the mystery has a human cause. Let's think, if you're thinking of something that you might be more familiar with, say, The Hound of the Baskervilles, rather than somebody, well, Dracula, just shortly before that, where evil is a real active principle. And you go back into the late 18th century, so Lewis's The Monk, which is one of the most troubling and famous of the stories, you know, you have diabolical figures in it and ultimately a devil. Whereas in Mrs. Radcliffe, there tends to be a rational explanation of what appears to be mystery.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking mostly and understandably about adult fiction. What was the developing market for writing children's books during this period? Were they all morality tales or history lessons? Differences between books for boys and girls? Could you see this market as just something that grew from the development of kind of middle class consumerism? What was the origins and development of that market?
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, in many senses, the classic interpretation, the J.H. Plum interpretation, is exactly as you put it, middle-class consumerism. I actually would say it's more complex than that, and I would say one background to it is the catechism, the idea that this is a catechizing literature designed to encourage people to be good little Christians. And I think it's no accident that if you're looking, you know, if you're looking at juvenilia, you know, in other words, writing by people which is young, which is an aspect of children's literature, you get some really quite interesting ranges. I've already mentioned Jane Austen. Not only does she write, of course, A Child's History of England, which is fascinating in its heroes and villains, but she also writes juvenilia, which is somewhat different, some of it quite violent, her adult novels. What I would say is, again, one's got a number of different themes here. There is no one template. The kind of, in hindsight, people afterwards were always critical of the 18th century. You know, they said it for the 19th century, it lacked seriousness. For the 20th century, it was oppressive. For the 21st century, they don't like it where it appears in the identity wars. It was very easy to make fun of children's literature and, you know, sort of exemplary type. Of course, look at the exemplary type of stuff we're churning out at the present moment, which is all about what reflects on our values as a society positively. So I think one has to be cautious about arguing that an exemplary literature is necessarily banal. It may be banal, but it isn't necessarily so. But also, one has to be wary of assuming that it all comes from just one form. And you mentioned the neo-Gothic. There were, in the early 19th century in particular, sort of neo-Gothic tales for children. And I think it's fair to say many of them were more sort of boys' own adventure types than ones in which you were all supposed to end up as good Christians. Not that the two are incompatible, of course.
No, indeed. We're drawing towards a close, but I want to ask, many listeners will obviously be familiar with some of the great novelists of the century, the Austens, the Richardsons, the Defoes, the Fieldings, and so on. Which, from your reading and understanding of the century, which were the great novelists, the great writers who were popular at the time, who've just totally faded from the popular consciousness, but actually listeners, if they have the time, could revisit with great profit?
Well, they could revisit with great profit. Whether they would want to, I don't know. I mean, as you will know, Richardson with Pamela most famously, though that wasn't by any means his only novel, had an enormous impact and is now very little read. I have to tell you, having read Richardson, I think Fielding had it right when he made a satire of it. But if you're looking at Fielding, for example, Fielding's novel Amelia doesn't tend to attract much attention. And indeed, it was less popular with contemporaries than either Tom Jones or Joseph Andrews. And that's a novel that's worth reading and about the pressures life brings on, human relationships. I don't mean this is necessarily good or bad. There is, in some respects, it's quite modern in a way that the stilted language of Richardson might make you feel, and its epistolary context and content might make you feel that was less modern. And then there are, most people these days would rather read Ulysses than Lawrence Stern. But actually, I think Lawrence Stern is marvellous, the way he moves in a kind of sort of deliberately incoherent fashion to make some profound points about human society. So I think that, yes, I think if you were to look at Lawrence Stern as somebody who now is very rarely read, I think you'd find him quite interesting.
So Lawrence Stern and Henry Fielding are your top novelist reading tips. Professor Jeremy Black, this has been a breeze through the particularly the literary world of the 18th century. And I thank you very much for it indeed.
My pleasure.